Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast, conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their stories about difficult decisions they've made for their company or any organization, or in some cases for themselves. My goal is to share these stories with the broader leadership community so you will be a more successful leader of your organization. We have a great guest today with a compelling story to tell. You will hear about lessons learned, you know, what went right, what went wrong, and key takeaways that will make you a better leader of your organization. I'm excited to introduce Frances West. Frances is a technology company executive with deep experience, as you'll hear from her story. She's a board member and a keynote speaker. So Frances, welcome to the Create the Future podcast. Tell us about your journey up to this point.
Well, thank you, Rick, for this invitation. Lovely day in snowy Boston, and I just got back from Singapore, so what a contrast. So I'm founder of Frances West & Co. This is a technology strategy and also kind of a global advisory company. It's based on my 30-plus experience working for IBM. I spent my entire professional life, I guess you can say, in this company called IBM, and went through many different divisions and jobs. And it really gave me a broad base of both perspective and also experiences in working in the tech world and also in the business world, which included myself working in, started out in Lexington, Kentucky, and then Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then came on to Boston, and then went on a foreign assignment to China in the 90s, and then came back to Boston and been here ever since. So it's been a very, I would say, fruitful and interesting and dynamic journey I've been on.
Well, you and I, just so the audience knows, you and I have met before a number of times. You're one of my absolutely favorite people. And I know you've had incredible experiences, not only in the U.S., but outside the U.S. And you wanted to come on the podcast and talk about a decision or multiple decisions that you've made and share your experiences going through that. So tell us a little bit about kind of a difficult decision you make or series of decisions. Get us started with that conversation.
Sure. One of the decisions I made was in the mid-90s. During a time when I actually, IBM as a company for the first time was going through some hardship. For those of you who know the history of IBM, we have always had CEO that's grown from the inside, so to speak. But in this case, IBM was actually under siege, and we brought in Lou Gerstner as the CEO from outside, and it was a huge change for the company culture and everything. So it was a lot of challenges, and I was actually was right in the middle of my career. I guess you can say it was on the upswing of things. But then this, you know, major market shift causing IBM to downsize and everything. So it was a very challenging time. And I was actually on track to get to the next executive level. But then the situation was so challenging that I started looking both at myself and also my family and just what is the best decision I can do for both my family and also for the business. And then that led to a very chanced encountering of an opportunity in China. And I'm an immigrant, first generation immigrant, born in Taiwan, raised in Hong Kong. But then I came to the United States at 19, met my husband, fell in love. The rest is history. So I started my IBM career actually in Lexington, Kentucky. When I saw the opportunity to go to China to help IBM open up the financial services sector, including working with the Central Bank of China, or the People's Bank of China, and also insurance industries mm-hmm. and the capital markets like Shanghai Stock Exchange, I thought that should be a no-brainer because I speak Chinese, I write Chinese, that's my native language. It should be no problem, and I can help IBM tremendously. So I took the chance and moved my entire family, my husband, my two young sons, my mother, and also our cat, Mei Mei, flew all the way from from Boston to Beijing right after Christmas in 1993. And it turned out to be the most profound decision I've made, both professionally and personally. Mm-hmm. Now, professionally, I'm very proud to say that my team, we built the China payment system, which is the Federal Reserve equivalent of interbank clearing system for Chinese, for People's Bank of China. We also introduced Lotus Notes. For those of you who are in the Boston area, will know Lotus was a very, very well-known company for the first generation of desktop computing, yeah. so to speak. And also we built the Shanghai Stock Exchange and brokerage system. And but during this whole 3-year journey, for me personally, it was quite a awakening as well, because I went into China market. By the way, I had the responsibility actually for China, Hong Kong, and also Taiwan. So what they call the Greater China area. So I thought, you know, I speak Mandarin, I speak Cantonese, I read the language, should be no problem. 6 months into my assignment, I remember coming home, and thank God my husband is a clinical psychologist. I literally crawl on the sofa and lie down and said to my husband, "Oh my God, I'm not Chinese." Because what I realized is that all the, you know, the business etiquettes or business ethics or business process is all American. And here I am, even though I look and speak, I think Chinese, but I'm not Chinese. So it was such an identity crisis for me that I really have to rework and reconstitute myself internally to understand who I am, and then how I can leverage my, I guess you can call it American know-how, so to speak, and apply it to the China environment. And I give you, since this call is really about leadership, I can give you one example. That is, in the U.S., at least at the time, in the 90s, you know, teamwork was really the way to motivate people. You know, you want to share as much as information as you can with a teammate and encourage them to empower them to lead on. But I didn't realize that the whole culture in China, the education system and everything, is more top down. So it's very much, you know, follow the leader kind of a thing. So when I was trying to share the knowledge and asking for input, at times actually it got perceived as weaknesses. Like, you don't know what you're doing, so therefore you have to ask for advice from us. So I had to really rethink and readjust my leadership style. I won't say that I went from being a kind of collaborative leader to an authoritative leader, but I certainly have to understand that I am dealing with a different kind of upbringing and also the cultural norm. So I have to adjust my leadership style. So this reminded me when I was in the IBM Management Training 101, one of the first things they taught us is a situational leadership. That is, you have to have a different style of leadership to adjust to the environment. Mm-hmm. Boy, did I benefit from that early learning from IBM Management Training, because in this case, I have to adjust very quickly to be effective as a leader.
Well, that is a wonderful story. So, I mean, at the simple level, it's you assumed that because everybody else in your life thinks you're Chinese, that when you go to China, you will just be another Chinese. And when you got there, they said, "You're not Chinese, you're an American."
Well, actually, it was very subtle. They didn't think I was American. They thought I was Chinese, so they actually, because I was in a sales position, so I
Okay.
still remember the my customer were leaning into me and in Chinese, and they would say all these things. You know, in sales, you kind of have to read the customer response and all that. And they would lean into me and they would say, "Oh, you know, Manager Wong, you know what I mean, you know." And I'm like, "Yeah, I know what you mean, but I have no idea what he meant, you know." So in other words, there's a lot of nuances in the conversation I was missing. It also taught me that early on that I have to really lean on my local team to do the interpretation for me as to what the customer's really saying and they're such or implying, especially when you're in the complex negotiation. But in the end, I had to be really be mindful of who I am, and this actually brought me to I actually wrote this story into a book. As you probably know, I wrote a book called "Authentic Inclusion Drives Disruptive Innovation." In that, what I realized that when you talk about inclusion, it's not just about identity inclusion, not just because you're female or you're Asian or In this case, I am in a country where with my same heritage, same color of skin, same, outlook, but I felt excluded. Not because they intentionally to exclude me, but I did not have the same cultural learning and background because I left when I was 19, like I said. So I thought I understood, but I didn't. And then, so I really have to adjust to my own interpretation. And also, it broadened my sense of what inclusion is about, right? I mean, you could be included or excluded within your same affinity group. So one just have to be very mindful and also somewhat fluid, so to speak, in your dealing with situation like that. And when I kind of my biggest takeaway from that 3-year experience is that in the end, you kind of have to be relating to each other as what I call human first, as people, as person, and then lean on them to teach you sometimes and to advise you and be vulnerable to let them know, hey, in this case, I don't know what you're talking about because, I've been working in the United States. And so I built it into to be an actual advantage to be a Chinese, but not a Chinese, because that gave me a way to say, here I'm bringing something extra or different, to this business conversation, versus the same old, same old.
You're reminding me, and I do want to get into the process of kind of going through decision making about, okay, what to do about all this. But you're reminding me of a story I want to share because I think it does relate to this. And I have not been to China. I will just say that before I even tell the story I was going to tell, I will tell. Let me tell another story. That is that I used to work with a fellow who went on a trade mission, whatever, right after Nixon opened China to the U.S., opened the China to the U.S. And so he was there, I mean, literally within 6 months or so after Nixon had been there. And he was with a delegation of Americans, and there was maybe 30 of them or something that were staying at a hotel in Beijing. And in the morning, they would go out and meet a bus that would take them around to wherever they were going to go for their meetings. And they're literally standing on the sidewalk in front of the hotel. And the Chinese had never seen a Westerner. And they came up to them, sort of a crowd around them, just looking at them. So the Chinese are just literally standing on the sidewalk looking at them. And they would go over and they just touch them. Are you real? I mean, it is so different now, but that was the experience that they had, gosh, 50 years ago. I don't remember how long ago it was now, but it was, there are big cultural differences. So I wanted to share a story about, this is actually before COVID, and there's a U.S.-China healthcare, I'm forgetting what exactly the title was, but they would bring 30 or 40 very senior level healthcare leaders from China to Boston for a 2 or 3 week program where they're studying at Harvard. And so they study at the Harvard Medical School and other places. And toward the end of that program, they put on an all-day conference and they asked me to come and moderate a panel discussion of CEOs of technology companies with in the healthcare technology space. So I was moderating a panel of CEOs for the conference. And I spent much of the morning before my panel talking with people. There, a lot of them spoke English, not all of them, but a lot of them spoke English. They had simultaneous translation going on, and they were very engaging. The people I met individually were very engaging and open about what they'd learned and who they were and blah, blah, blah. So at the beginning of the panel discussion, I did what I always do, and I said to the audience, I said, look, your questions will be very important to the panel and to help us, the panel, give you what you really want, will find most interesting to you. So your questions are going to be an important part of this whole, the value coming from listening to this panel discussion. I mean, I would say that to any audience. And I didn't really think much about it, but after the panel members had given their talk about what their company was doing and where they saw healthcare technology going, I had some conversation among the panel, and then I opened it up for questions. Not a single hand went up. The Chinese who are listening, either because they understood English or listening in simultaneous translation, wouldn't ask a question. And here I had allowed like 20 minutes for a Q&A. And I said, what do I do now? I mean, fortunately, there were some Americans in the crowd who raised their hands and they started asking questions. And after this was all over, I said, well, what went wrong? Why wouldn't they ask any questions? Oh, they're not going to ask questions in front of their peers and mm-hmm. look like they don't know
right.
the answer. It was a complete cultural misunderstanding on my part
right.
of what was completely normal for them.
Right. Exactly. That's a great example of how, and also, especially in a crowd kind of a setting, you know, one do not stick up, you know, like a nail, because then you potentially get hammered down. So it's not a place to show off, so to speak, you know, because they can also perceive you to be trying to be a wannabe, you know, to showcase your whatever. So yeah, that is a great example of a cultural differences.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you were in a situation where you had to adapt, whatever the right word is. And I don't know if you saw this as a particular decision you had to make about how do I do this or what should I do? How did you go about, you know, solving what was the right way to go? Did you talk with other people who were there or talk with your mom or...
All the above. I mean, what I ended up realizing is that I really have to set aside my U.S. experience and be very open about receiving input from both my employees and also my peer managers who've been there, you know. And also, I started thinking back of how my father and mother, when they were living in Taiwan, you know, I mean, I'm always listening to their conversation about business and this and that, you know, and I start kind of channeling my father's business thinking into my day-to-day. But a very interesting thing is that I had to make a decision, to what extent do I want to go all the way to become Chinese, or do I want to stay... how much do I want to stay quote-unquote American Chinese? Because there is a difference between Chinese, American Chinese. And that was looking back and now 30-some years later, it's probably one of the best, you know, at the time it was not like what we're talking about. At the time it was just like trying to survive, trying to do the best I can. But looking back now, is probably one of the best mental exercise I have to go through, is to always know who you are and where you are. Because if I become completely Chinese, then I won't be able to introduce, I think, or be as effective introducing new ideas and new thoughts and be able to influence the customer's thinking about, for example, the solution or the technology, the architecture that they are considering from IBM. But if I'm too American, you know, then I could come across as, you know, you're just here to like tell us what to do. Because Chinese, even back then, I mean, Chinese has always been a very proud country, and they are very hardworking. They can learn as fast, if not faster, than anybody in the world. So you have to be very respectful for their abilities, but at the same time, add value to that. So, so anyway, so this forced me to tap into the 360-degree help that I can get or get feedback, you know, and then you constantly, every single day, you're trying to adjust, you know, your style, both management style, because that's another thing. When I went there, we basically had nothing. We were building an entire IBM organization from ground up, right? So I probably hired over 100 people in that 3-year period in different industry. We have to train these young kids. And then literally they go through the training, we send them out to support customers or to sell to the customer. So it's that kind of adjusting time training. It was very intense.
Let me just ask you a quick question. Were you hiring Chinese? You're primarily hiring Chinese, right?
Yes.
So most of the people you were working with were Chinese.
Yes.
And did you get to the point where you found that there were a couple of them that you could say, hey, you know, I'm trying to figure out myself how best to relate here. Give me feedback. Or were you having to do that kind of thinking this through on your own, or were there other Americans?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
how did that process work for you?
No, I mean, they are a couple employees. I will call them the high performing employees that I can lean in and get some feedback and all that. But again, it's very tricky, right? I mean, if I lean in too much, like I said, it will be perceived potentially, you know, so as a weaknesses. Right. And then, and especially in an emerging market when it's very chaotic.
Yeah.
And when you try to lead the troops, you really have to be quite decisive. You know, you cannot be wishy-washy about it.
Right.
But they are definitely are. And also my peers, you know, I will get, you know, input from them. And you try to get, you know, input from, and also you get it. I tell you what, the most input I get is from my customers. It's because I was in sales, right? It's very, in the end, it's the KPI is very simple. They buy or not buy from you, right? So after like 6 months or so, I can sense whether that I'm making progress or not in terms of my effectiveness, because you can see whether they're going to sign with us or not, because it was highly competitive. Everybody was in the China market trying to get a share of the business. So so it was a very, when I went to China, I remember when I was packing up for this overseas assignment, they call it hardship assignment at the time, IBM. I thought, hardship. It's not going to be hardship, because they put us up at this kind of Lido compound where there is a swimming pool. It's almost like a expat compound. So I packed my tennis outfit. I packed my, you know, nice evening, you know, outfit. I thought I'm just going to have a walk in the park kind of experience. Never did I expect to be such a hardship, really a hardship assignment. So that's another thing. It's like, you don't know what you don't know, you know. Yeah. But I'm glad I didn't know, because if I didn't know, I probably would not take in the assignment. It was too hard. But yeah. Anyway.
So you're reminding me that one of my Harvard Business School classmates who was, I don't think he was an American. I think he was Dutch or something. I'm not remembering. But anyway, he went to Japan and eventually became essentially CEO of one of the major natural gas distributing companies in Japan. And I talked to him at sort of class reunions and that sort of thing about his experience in Japan. And I asked him if he had learned to speak Japanese. And he said, at first, when he first got there, he thought about taking Japanese language lessons so he could learn Japanese. And then he realized that actually it wasn't the right thing for him to do, because there are so many subtleties in how the Japanese speak their language that they're as a native Japanese, you're very attuned to. And it's basically you understand the class, where you are in the class structure by exactly how you speak the language. And he said, no matter how much effort he put in, he would be a second-class citizen in Japan by his speaking Japanese as a language. So he said it wasn't worth his doing that, and he purposely didn't do it for that reason. I have to say, I mean, because it's he came to understand that the limitations in the culture made it so that it wasn't worth or a good idea for him to try to, in effect, become Japanese or enough Japanese mm-hmm. so he could relate at that level. And I think here in the United States, now you and I are both live in the Boston area, and I am at the moment in Florida. And, you know, whether we like it or not, there are big cultural differences within the United States. Mm-hmm. And if you are a Bostonian and deep into the sort of, I don't know, I'm going to say the politics, but the culture of that area, of our area where you and I live, and we get relocated or say we're going to move to Houston, Texas, boy, you have to be sensitive to the fact that Houston, Texas is not Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Boston, yeah. Massachusetts, or New York City and Manhattan. That right. If you go there and say the world operates the way I think it should because I'm from Manhattan, you're going to be in big trouble and not be successful as a leader of your organization. So it's not just, you know, we're talking about you're going to China and saying, I can't pretend that I'm Chinese, but I need to understand how to successfully be a leader in that culture. It's no different than somebody who says, oh, gee, I've been successful in high tech in Boston, and I'm now going to go to Houston and be the same way, and it just will not work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that's why I'm very grateful that I actually, in my early career, I started, like I said, in Lexington, Kentucky, right? And then Grand Rapids, Michigan. These are all, I guess you can call it a different political orientation than, say, Cambridge, Massachusetts places. And also, I was like, in the early days, I was like the one and only Asian and one and only woman carrying the IBM flag, so to speak, and selling to customers in manufacturing industry, in defense industry. And that early exposure to the different culture, different thinking, different people was absolutely important to help to shape my way of thinking, my way of leadership, and all these things. And that came out to be very helpful in my later years, and to be truly what I call authentically respectful and also inclusive of different thoughts and different ideas and different opinions and all that.
Well, okay, I want you to develop this a little bit further. And I'm going to repeat this again, that you and I know each other. So it's not like we're best buddies, but we're best professional colleagues. And you are talking about something that is extremely important to me, and you are a perfect person to develop this idea. That I say that if you are not open to listening and learning different points of view with people from people who have a different background and experience than you do, you will not be successful as a leader. And you bring to this, to that perspective, a particular point of view about culture and women and not being sort of the average, you know, middle-class white guy that, you know, we ordinarily think of as that's who the CEO is. So it's really not true any longer. But nonetheless, talk a little bit more about why being open to what people can bring to the table who have different backgrounds and different experiences, life experiences, and different points of view. Why is that valuable to me as a leader?
So I was very thrilled to be quoted by the Forbes just last week. What are the top skills a CEO or C-suite needs to focus on in 2026? And I, as an expert panel contributors, I gave my thoughts, and then it was included in that. I put it on the LinkedIn. What I talked about is that this able to have a diverse perspective and diverse point of view is so important, especially nowadays when the world is upside down. You know, you know, there's no such things as a standard operating procedure anymore, right? I mean, every day, everything's changing domestically, internationally, politically, financially, geopolitically. So as leaders, you really have to be very nimble in your decision-making, and you really have to have either you yourself have to be very multidisciplinary skill sets, or you have a cadre of people that you can lean on to provide you with a multi, you know, a different perspective. And you mentioned I'm keynote speakers, and sometimes when I talked about leadership, I have a 4L theory. So the 4L for leadership, first one is listen. To be a good leader, especially nowadays, you have to listen very intently. You have to listen. You have to be not just hearing, but really listening, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, you really have to learn. You have to, you know, like we talked about the cultural differences, your friend in Japan. I mean, he actually made a conscious effort to understand whether he should or should not learn Japanese, right, in that kind of context. So learning is actually very important to be part of the leadership of anything. And then the third thing I feel like is that, you know, in the complex world like this, you know, some of the lived experience is so important, that if you don't have the lived experience, but at least have an empathy to understand other people's lived experience, the background. Like for me, you know, I was very lucky. I got hired in Lexington, Kentucky in 1979. I mean, as only the first female Asian immigrant, you know, I have to give this branch manager, Frank Fischersdorf, credit for seeing who I am and respect my lived experience, because at that time I only had waitressing as my only sales experience, but he saw something in me, right? And to say, well, you know, this young lady is worth IBM hiring. So he's a white male and never, you know, have the immigrant experience, but he respected and understood and want to learn from my lived experience. Then I feel like after you have listened, you have learned, you have either your own lived experience or lived experience through proxy, then you can lead. Then you really earn the rights to lead. But without these, you know, kind of prerequisites, then the leadership potentially may not be as sustainable and also may not be as effective.
Oh boy, I think that is great. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we can wrap it up. And that is, you packed your family up to move from the U.S. to China. I'm sure you've done, I mean, I know you've done other important things like that, where it was a big decision you had to make for a big change, including moving back to the U.S. Talk a little bit about where you get the courage to do things like that. Where, about you personally, where do you find the courage to make big changes like that?
Well, looking back, it seems like I always make these, you know, decision that is almost like leaping into the unknowns. Even my last job in IBM Research, I ended up heading up the global team of working on technology for aging and people with disabilities, which led me to become IBM's first chief accessibility officer. What that means is that making sure that technology is accessible to people who are aging and people with disabilities. And these are not mainstream topics, you know. Like one of my mentors says, Francis, what are you doing? You're going into the weeds, you know. Not many people care about disability or whatever. You know, you should stay in financial services and mainstream financial services kind of a thing. But I always made a decision in the context of my family needs and wants. I felt like, just like my decision making in China, I felt like at the time, the U.S. environment, the overall economic environment, it was so challenging that I, as a professional, is so stressed that I needed a change in environment field so that I can be more, feel more, that I feel like I can be not so much in control, but I can have an edge, so to speak, you know, And so going to China was one of those situations. And I have to say, my husband has been very, very supportive. And we all know that you cannot go through life to have family and kids and everything without having a spouse. So he was very supportive in making these major decisions. And I think this comes back to having a bit of confidence and also faith that I can, whatever it is thrown at me or whatever environment I decide to jump into, I can land on my two feet. This goes back to my early days as an immigrant, I guess you can say. You know, when I arrived in this country, you know, barely speak English, and, you know, I made my way through universities with scholarship and then went on to work for IBM. Every time when I get a situation gets tough, I just think, okay, somebody has done it before, so I should be able to do it. So just put my helmet on and just jump in and see how it goes. And so far it has paid off. You cannot think too much. I always say to people, it's almost like having children. I don't know. You have children. It's like, if you think too much, you will never do it, right? I mean, it's like it seems like there's just all a lot of hardship and all that. But on the other hand, the satisfaction and the lesson learned along the way is priceless. So I think one of the things about, I think, me being I guess you can call it a leader, is this: is always be curious and always be courageous, and then have confidence. And that's my three C's. Now you got my four L's, my three C's, courage, curiosity, and confidence. That will help you through.
Okay, you got the three C's. I like that. You're reminding me of our watching the Olympics and the skiers up at the top of the ski slope. And I could never in a million years do that. And what you're saying is that they're sitting there and they saw that other people had gone down that ski lift. They'd done it before themselves. And they know that when they get started, they can master shooting down that ski slope, doing a loop or whatever in the heck they're going to do. And that's where they get the courage that they've seen it done before and they're going to do it themselves. Well, yep. Frances, this has been great. Thank you for sharing your experiences. I know you've made a valuable contribution to everyone's understanding of how you deal with situations and challenges like this. Where can the audience learn more about you?
Well, they can LinkedIn me, Frances West, on LinkedIn, or my website, franceswest.co, not .com, but .co is my website that highlights some of the work I do with the startups, with enterprise customers in the whole area of digital inclusions and also business strategy for growth in markets, both inside and also outside the United States.
I know you're great, great at what you've done, very successful. I encourage people to follow up with you. So I want to thank our audience for tuning in and taking the time to engage with our guests, and I hope you have found this valuable. If you have a compelling story to tell about making important decisions for yourself or for your company, please contact me. Go to rickwilliamsleadership.com. And then go to the Create the Future podcast section on my website. So again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. Remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. So take the time to get important decisions right, and yes, have some fun. So until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast, conversations with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.